the term in director's education is noses in, fingers out. So we have a role and a responsibility as someone charged with governance to make sure that the train's not going off the tracks, but it's not our role to pull the levers and try to steer that train.
Hi, team, and welcome to the CEO Podcast. This is a place where we will have conversations on culture and team chemistry. We will deconstruct why there actually is an I in team from the strategies and attributes of the highest impact people and teams out there, so that in turn, you can apply as tools in your life, business, and sports. My name and your host is Kevin Rutherford. I'm a CEO and leader by trade and training. I've directed teams to successful acquisition and exit, while also creating recognized cultures where people want to work and play. So let's jump right into today's episode. All right, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Chief Eternal Optimist Podcast. And I'm joined here with my friend and I think now a legend. Maybe that's too soon because he's too young, but Mike Fatta in the natural products industry. So, Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I think, you know, 25 years, so young, but plenty of experience in this industry.
Plenty of experience, very fair. Where in the world would we find you today?
I'm at home, just outside of Winnipeg in sunny Manitoba, Canada.
Sunny Manitoba, Canada. What is Winnipeg best known for?
Being friendly. You know, it says friendly Manitoba right on the license plates here, which I have a theory to that, you know, why people settled in the middle of the prairies that get down to minus 40 degrees in the winter. You have to be friendly. If you're not friendly and you're left alone, you could die. So yeah, I think you got to be friendly. So overall, people are friendly here.
I think that logic makes a ton of sense. I've never heard it that way before. And by the way, I think you know this, but for anyone else out there, I too, of course, most of my listeners will know I'm Canadian, but I've never been to Manitoba. So got to check that box soon. Yep.
Got to check. The other fun fact about Winnipeg is Winnie the Pooh is from here.
What?
Yeah.
Winnie the Pooh's from Winnipeg or from Manitoba in general?
From Winnipeg. Yeah, that's where he got his name. Winnie from Winnipeg. Yep. And there's a certain part of town where that author was living that the fire hydrants and stuff are Pooh characters. It's pretty cool.
I think it's super cool. I can't wait to see this. So anyway, thank you for sharing. Well, we have so much to dig into today. And, you know, what we tend to focus in on, Mike, is, as you and I chatted about before, is a lot about leadership, culture. You know, Mark Messier, good legend from Canada, in terms of hockey, you know, has a book out and it says nobody wins alone. And that always inspires me to think about that in terms of team and life, business and sports. So I'm curious to dig into that. And when I think about you getting here today and what the DNA is when you were younger, what helped formed who you are today when, as a kid, as an example, like, did you play any team sports? Maybe there's something else that formed you and that just kind of helped you be the person you are today and the leader that you are.
Yeah. That's a loaded question. I would say, you know, it's the opposite. I was the lazy kid. I didn't have any friends. I fell prey to fast food and found myself, you know, weighing 300 pounds. So I was unhealthy, just not well, not feeling good at all. And then one day decided to flip the script. And so I think that what I learned about leadership and a number of things that have changed in my life were I needed to embody that. And all of a sudden, one day, I decided I want to be a good leader. And then from there, I started developing habits and looking at what does good leadership look like and where can I get examples of that from? How big is the gap between where I am right now and where I want to be? And then what action steps can I take to get there? So it really started not even from the ground level, more so from the basement. I was going a long way for a long time.
Can we unpack that a little bit?
For sure.
So I'm thinking about, like you said, one day,
And the thing is, the build up to that one day. So I'm curious about the moment, the inflection point that made you go, I need to shift. But what was happening on that? I don't know if I want to call it a downward spiral or just how about down in the basement, if you will, and you're feeling stuck and you're just keep going back to the same bad habits. Like you said, fast food as an example, sedentary lifestyle, which I did know this one. And I think I'm glad you brought it up because I think there's a lot of people that can resonate with this. And then, so what were you feeling? What were the emotions? What was leading to, and why did you feel unstuck? And then what was the catalyst all of a sudden? Bang, let's go.
Yeah. I was just sick and tired all the time. You know, life was really feeling shitty. The only thing that was giving me any kind of, feeling of goodness or hit was the dopamine hits of instant gratification. So I thought at that time, I need my $20 for today so I could buy a pack of cigarettes. I smoked, unfortunately, for like 8 years of my youth, and get a fast food meal. And that would make me feel good. But it didn't make me feel good. But I thought in my head, like that's what life was all about, getting enough resources to give myself these little hits of feeling good. But ultimately, I just kept on feeling worse and worse and worse. And the catalyst was really two things. I was just one day sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm like, I don't want to feel shitty anymore. And I believe that I can feel better. I believe that I can embody a healthy person. And you know, I'm open to say that I believe psychedelics had a part in that. Like I was experimenting at that time, more from, you know, taking psilocybin mushrooms that I wanted to go out and party with my friends. When it was a fun party, but at the end of the night, there was this piece of me that I didn't like certain things about myself. And I also started to see myself a different way. Like I could see what a healthier me looked like. So those were the big drivers, but also, you know, at 18 years old, I wanted a girlfriend that wasn't a friend. I had a lot of friends that were, you know, I was the cuddly teddy bear kind of guy, a nice guy, but wanted a girlfriend that was a friend that was also a motivator. And so I just decided one day, like, I'm not a smoker anymore. And as an example, and people were like, oh yeah, you've been smoking for 8 years. You're going to smoke forever. No, I'm not a smoker anymore. And I think that's that kind of change and embodying the new person that I wanted to become. And then even if I was failing at that a little bit, cause it did take me like 16 times to quit smoking. I was clear on what I wanted to be, you know, and instead of incrementalizing my way there.
That is interesting. The failed 16 times, right? But then you kept going and until you,
yeah, and I kept going because it wasn't like, oh, I want to quit smoking one day. Mm-hmm. It was, I'm not a smoker anymore. And yeah, the first time I failed, I went like 4 days and I failed, but and I give you that example of him because I've used that in so many different aspects of changing my life personally to the better me, like going from 300 pounds to more an athletic minded person. And then also in business from dropping out of high school and having no business experience, having no skill set and embodying a leader and then just being a leader, always showing up and improving myself, even if I was failing a little bit.
Does the power of streaks motivate you? So as an example, did you quit smoking? It was 4 days and then I had one and then I got to 5 days or 8 or 11 days. Was that ever a role? And I'll get to why I'm asking that because it's maybe a little bit of motivation for myself sometimes.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe not to the smoking piece exactly. I was just becoming conscious then, I would say, you know, I was just learning, but I like streaks because of momentum. I'm a big believer in momentum. You know, it is really tough to get the boulder rolling when you first start pushing it. But when you get it going and you get some momentum, it's a lot easier to keep it going than it is for it to stop, start. So I do see that in aspects of kind of life and for sure in business is that when you get momentum started, you just have to go all in and keep that going.
Was plant-based eating part of that shift back then, or is that later? And are you still eating a plant-based diet?
I eat a lot of plants. I did a lot of fad diets or experimental diets on myself. So I was researching when I started to lose the weight, I started researching different diet types. The first diet was the no-fat diet, very popular in the mid-1990s, Dr. Nathan Pritikin. And so I read a couple of his books and I was like, if you don't eat any fat, you're going to lose weight. So I started eating no fat, which, you know, fast forward a year or two, and I realized that no fat eating is really like chemical shitstorm. You know, like they make all these foods that don't have fat in them, but they put sugar or put other preservatives or chemicals or different things in it. But that got me started down the diet experiments. And then I did go, I was a vegetarian for a couple of years, and then I was a vegan for almost 2 years. And then I was a raw food vegan for about a year. And all of that was very cleansing on my, you know, I had to heal my body and heal my, even after I lost the weight, there was a lot of things going wrong in my body, and I needed to do a lot of cleansing. And so that was very cleansing. But ultimately I realized for my body type, for me, the Mediterranean type diet is best. So predominantly, you know, probably 80% fruits and vegetables. But I do eat meat. I do eat fish. I do eat a little bit of dairy. I think about animal products as strengthening for my system, and plants, fruits and vegetables are nourishing and cleansing.
I love it. My story, here's why I'm asking some of those questions, because I just make it about me all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's your show.
So I actually gave up meat. I don't even know how long it is. I'm going to say 15 years. It might be more than that now. I actually don't know the number of years. I should keep track of this. But here's where the story goes about streaks. I decided I wanted to increase energy levels and didn't want a 2 o'clock in the afternoon lull. And so I started doing my own investigation, and I learned that meat was really hard to digest. It just takes a long time. It's physiology. It's not debatable. It's biology. Like, it is what it is. And that's actually what drove me to say, okay, I'm going to cut this out. I'm going to try it. I didn't even know what vegan was. So speaking of that, in fact, I didn't even know what raw vegan was. And that's what I ended up doing. I was eating a raw vegan diet. Unfortunately, I started to lose weight, and I didn't actually need to lose weight. In this case, I was fortunate from that perspective. And so my girlfriend, now wife, but girlfriend at the time, Kelly, she's like, Kevin, you need to eat more. I go, I'm constantly eating. And she goes, you're eating like rabbit food. So I decided to go in there. But where it goes on streaks was this. When I got to 100 days, now I've introduced back some dairy and fish, by the way, at this point, but meat was gone. And my friends were like, all right, let's grill out. Let's party, celebrate this whole thing. I'm like, I want to keep going. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah. I didn't define myself, like you said, I'm not a smoker. I didn't define myself, I'm not a like an anti-meat eater or whatever. I just said, I want to keep the streak going. So I kept streaking, if you will, not bring my hat like Will Ferrell, but streaking in this case. And I got to a year. Then my friends thought for sure I was going to do the grill out of steaks and whatever. And then I was like, I actually don't think I want it anymore. And so I never went back. So for whatever it's worth, I will say, I was very strict vegan most of the time since then. And even today, I would say I'm more like 90, 95%, but I travel quite a bit and I'm on the go. And so sometimes there's dairy in something that I eat. And then if I can't find something else, I'll have fish as well. So I totally appreciate what you're saying on that as well. So anyway, that just thought I'd share it with you. We actually have a lot in common here in a different way, and some things common, some things how we got there was different. So, okay, here you are, and you've had a couple of successful exits on businesses, right? What was the role in your mind about team and culture when it comes to those businesses and growing them to the point that you had a successful exit? And we'll get into leadership about you, but I actually want to dig into team first, if we could.
Sure. Yeah. At Manitoba Harvest, which, you know, is my baby. So there's been thankfully now exits outside of that as an investor and as a chairman of a board, but at Manitoba Harvest, I growing the business to $100 million, we had three different, mostly full changeovers in team, full change in the senior leadership team first. So, as you can imagine, like a hemp food company in 1998, we were anyone that wanted to work for the business that was somewhat qualified, like we brought them in because most people thought we were crazy. There was no hiring anyone that used to work at General Mills or anything like that, you know, in the beginning years. And so, you know, but after we grew the business, you know, really, I think for the first 10 years until we got to about 10 million in revenue, at 10 million in revenue, we raised venture capital. And then I realized, oh, we need a real team that's done it before. And it was still weird. Believe it or not, hemp was still weird. That was like now 2008, but at $10 million, you know, it was still a weird company, but we started to attract some people that had worked for other food companies, maybe not the big food, you know, Fortune 100 food companies, but more established food companies that had experience. And then I started thinking about team in two different ways, especially from senior leadership. One, someone that's done it before. And then when you put together a number of people that have done it before in a leadership role, I started to be able to gauge the capacity of the whole senior leadership team. And I think that served me really well when we scaled from 10 to 50 million and we had our first exit where private equity bought majority of the business. And then we re-upped that senior leadership team for the third time and at that time did hire very talented people that had worked in large food and beverage and they had a capacity to take the business well past $100 million. And so when we sold the business in 2019, a big part of it, of the acquirer that bought us, they wanted the team and they could see that that team had capacity to grow the business to 200 million or more. So I thought about, like, you know, it wasn't only experience. It was like how strong was our culture and our system so that our team together could operate with always more capacity than the sales that we were currently at.
How did you know to do that? You know, because here's the thing, there's different stages of companies. And so what got you here may not get you there, right? And that's basically what you're outlining. And I think that's really astute and smart. Yet you hadn't done that before. Mm-hmm. So how did you know how to reframe and retool at these different inflection points?
Yeah. I mean, and there's all different kinds of leadership. My style of leadership is I've walked a mile in every single one of the roles at Manitoba Harvest over the years, over and over again. And so I was very conscious to what it was taking to be successful in the role at that time, whether it was a vice president of sales, whether it was our R&D manager, whether it was our plant or operations manager, I was in the role. And for a couple of those times when we had the team changeover where I hired a new senior leadership team, I had to unfortunately dismiss the person that was in that role before. I assumed their role for a couple of months, cleaned it up, reframed the job description and duties to what the new standard was that I was looking for, and then hired the individual. And so I think I'm operationally minded. That's why I see leaders that just lead, but they don't understand how to do the job. And they could be quite successful with that, right? You put people that can do the job and then they could lead them very well. I'm the kind of leader that my leadership was because I could do the job well and I wouldn't ask anyone to do anything that I wouldn't do myself. And the team really followed me because of that. Meaning, you know, when the plant facility was under construction, I'm downstairs like helping pour concrete and clean up the floors. And when when the wash bay needed to be reorganized, I was down there with the team. Like there was no job that was too small for me. And so I intimately knew the work well, which also makes fast forward to after we even left the company, what has made me successful in the last 5 years as an investor and an advisor. I still have that mentality. I understand what has to happen in each one of these positions in a company as it scales to different levels. And I offer that to the founders so that they can gain perspective, even if their leadership style is more leading, not leading from by example of like actually knowing the role.
Absolutely. I think that's really great advice. I am getting involved in guiding and advising like you on companies, one observation I've had is the transition of being founder and doing all tasks and jobs is really difficult for the founders to transition to leading and getting people to be really great at their jobs and letting them do their job. Did you experience that? And then of the companies you're advising, you have your eyes on many different companies and leaders. Are you seeing the same thing? Like, or am I just happen to be seeing it in the group of what, 15 companies that I've been working with over a period of time?
Yeah. I think about it like this. Founders are really good at working in the business. They created the business.
100%.
What they need to learn is to work on the business. As you know, when you transition to a CEO role and you have a full leadership team and your job is to actually lead the business, you have to be really good at governance, strategic planning, putting meetings together so everyone knows what their role is. Maybe that's, getting a board or investors aligned. That's a whole different job, because you're probably working on the business for more than 50% of the time. And those are hard, especially if you haven't done it before. So a lot of founders will go back to working in the business and then, run out of time and not have enough time to do those hard tasks. And sometimes we see that at a board level and the board goes, hey, this isn't acceptable. You were late on the reporting, the job, that part wasn't as good. Or you have all these great senior leaders, but they don't know what the next step in the vision of the company is, because the founder hasn't taken that time to make that clear for them. So yeah, mm-hmm. I struggled with that a bit, but our $0 to $100 million path was 20 years. So I think the amount of time it took to grow the business, that it didn't happen more rapidly than that, especially in the early years, gave me the foundation to figure some of that out, even coming from like a high school dropout. And so then when I left the business and I've coached several of the portfolio companies, my role coming in as chairman of the board and investor was explaining to the founder why it was going to be best for us to hire a CEO and for them to take a role in the business as, a chief innovation officer, or take more of a support and a sales and marketing role. And that's very challenging, especially when it's the founder didn't see that at first. And then I gave them the opportunity and then they failed. And then they came back to realize, oh, you're right, to where the business is going now. Usually that north of $20 million, is that inflection point for a lot of founders realizing that if they can't bridge over to be a great CEO, they're going to get hit on the head each day. The wave's going to hit them over the head. And then there's CEO leaders that just do that without even thinking. They could show up and just be a great leader because they were classically trained or they had other experience.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Those are tough dialogues too, and tough discussions. I'm sure it's not something you want to do, but you need to do it. You have to do it for them and for the organization, the team. What was the size of your business when you sold it to the private equity group?
You're about 50 million.
50? So Seth Godin has a book out from a while back. I had him call it 5-7 years, somewhere around there. And it's called The Dip. Have you ever heard of it? The premise is this, right? We all go through a dip personally in our lives. We go through dips in business, right? But business, what ends up happening is when you hit that dip, this is where most people quit, right? Because you can't see actually the way out yet. So you're in the dip. What was the dip for you before you were? And that's why I asked about the 50 million. I was thinking, that first 0 to 50, I bet you hit a dip on more than one occasion where you're like, I don't know if this is going to work.
Oh, there's constant. I mean, we, the first 5 years of the business, it took us 5 years to get to $1 million in sales, which, 99% of entrepreneurs don't get to $1 million in sales. So I don't say that lightly, but 5 years is a very long time. And I didn't get paid for the first couple of years of that.
Yep.
There was just it looked impossible for so many of those days. And really the thing that kept me going was that I loved hemp hearts. Hemp played such a positive role in my diet for where I was at that point. There was many nights I thought, if we fail and I quit, where am I going to get hemp hearts from? And that combined with testimonials that we were getting from you know, little lady senior citizens or people that our products were playing a positive role in their diet mm-hmm. and lifestyle just fired me up to say, I could just one more day, you know, just figure out a couple more things, you know, just give it a little bit more time. But even when we hit $1 million in sales after 5 years, my realization for the business that we were trying to stand up, because we were self-manufacturing and we had to deal with farmers and genetics of hemp seed, we were going to need to be a $10 million business to be sustainable and be profitable. So after 5 years and hitting the first million, then I was staring like, we need to be 10 times bigger
right.
to actually be successful. And it started all over again. And it wasn't until we were 10 years into the business that we actually hit that $10 million and that we were profitable and we were really sustainable at that time. And so, 3,650 days of having a strong vision that I believed it was going to work. We just weren't there yet. And we just needed to figure a couple more things out, you know, and just figure a couple more things out and do a couple other things today. And that's how I got myself through it.
What you said is really powerful. I really hope people kind of pause and think about this one, because what you did, I think, is a psychology 101, where you break things into smaller pieces and you start biting off, if you will, each piece. I remember distinctly a moment in time. I don't know why this is coming into my head. I'm doing Ride the Bay in San Diego with my wife, Kelly. She didn't even like riding bikes. She's like, fine, I'll do this. It's, I don't know, a 30-mile ride. And then we had to climb the bridge. It's called Coronado Bridge, going over Coronado Island. And she sees this thing and she's like, I cannot do this. I cannot make it. And I said, come on, you can do it. Come on, come on. Let's just get to that second lamppost. I didn't want to say the first one, because then that would be like, then she might stop. So I'm like, I got to get you momentum. Second lamppost. As we're coming up to the second lamppost, I go, let's get to the next one. Like, let's skip this one. Let's keep going. Let's go to another one. And sure enough, she's clearly telling herself, maybe I can do it. She's yelling at me, cursing at me. But we made it. And I think there's something about breaking things off into little pieces and just keep going. And of course, you're always learning while you're doing it. So you have to keep being adaptable and flexible, which you did. But it's those little pieces, and they add up brick by brick by brick.
Yeah. You know, and I was very fortunate that my mom was one of my first mentors. She was in business, and ultimately I hired her after in the company, but she was the one that shared with me. I always knew when I was young, I had a great imagination, you know, wild and crazy imagination when I was a kid. But when I started in business, my mom was like, well, you know, you have this gift that you could see things in the future, well into the future, and then break them down into like 1,000 parts. That's your gift. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I don't know if it was her reassurance or her pointing that out, but for sure, that is one of my strengths. And I think my own personal transformation, my health transformation before I got into business also helped that out, right? It's like one day at a time. Don't smoke cigarettes for today. I'm not a smoker anymore. Don't smoke cigarettes for today. Eat healthy for today. Let's get on eating healthy for this month. You know, I went into a streak of deciding just not to drink alcohol. I'm not going to drink alcohol for a year, you know, and then at the end of the year, that feels great. I'm not going to drink alcohol for another year, because I'm just, it gives me so much energy. But how we eat an elephant one bite at a time. And literally, I think it, like now, Kevin, I think about that 25 years later. And what I put out into the world is just think about like 100 reps of whatever you're doing. Yeah, do them one at a time, but like, don't get all caught up on like how hard this one is. Like, you can, because you got to break them down into small pieces, but you also got to know that it's going to suck. Whatever you're doing, you're not going to know what you're doing. It's going to be harder right off the bat. But if you could take yourself to the place like 100 times doing it, people will start saying, oh, you're an expert at this, or it comes natural to you. No, it doesn't. Nothing comes natural to me. I'm an introvert that went out and built a sales and marketing engine. And it came from putting myself on stage once, you know, and then thinking, okay, I'm just going to do that 10 more times. And okay, I'm going to just do that. I can do that like 100 more times. That's the secret to winning from my experience.
That's a drop the mic moment.
Oh, great.
Well played. Don't leave though. Don't leave yet. Seriously, that was a drop in the mic moment. Your mom saw that in you. I'm curious if mom was here and she was to say, well, little Mikey, here's why I say that. Here's why I say you have a vision, a way of envisioning something, right, and break into small pieces. Is there something that she would say, a story that really brought that to life well before this entrepreneurial effort?
You know, I think it was, I think my mom's an accountant. She was an accountant, right? And math has always been my strength. So I think she saw it through numbers first.
I got it.
Like I would do these projects. She worked for Shoppers Drug Mart for a 25-year career, and being the bookkeeper of Shoppers Drug Mart, she would have to do, you know, day end, weekend, month end kind of activities. So she'd bring some of those home because she was a single mom. And so I recall she'd bring home like 1,000 checks. Okay. That had to be sorted and put into a 0 to 1,000 pile. And then there was a bunch of other paper kind of transactions around that. And she had me and my brother involved. My brother was less interested. And so I was like, okay, I'll break this down and I could see how this is going to go. Like sort them all first, then get them in piles of 100, then get them in piles down to tens, and then sort those tens to the hundreds. And then all of a sudden you have the stack of 1,000. So I think it started there for her. And then it got intensified when I started talking to her about the business and the company and how I saw things progressing. I got to figure out a bottle for the hemp seed oil, and then there's a label, and then there's the print on it. And then we got to get into our first store and sharing, but it was a mathematical kind of formula or a mathematical basis to it.
I wouldn't have thought that, not like before you answer the question, but as you're saying, I'm like, that makes complete sense. So thanks for sharing that. I have so many questions for you. One of them I'm thinking about, being based out of Winnipeg as a location, must have been challenging, I'm assuming, to recruit talent. Aside from, you had a double whammy. You actually had hemp hearts, you know, that people seemed kind of freaky at the time. So as you started to get traction, did you have everyone work in Winnipeg, or was it a remote company?
Both. So when Manitoba is a great, you know, it's the center of the agriculture universe. And so it was great for the back end of the business. Everything to do with food manufacturing and even on farm and all of that, there is plenty of talent. But the front end of the business, sales and marketing, is very limited here. Anyone working in food and beverage is working in big food and beverage traditional jobs here. So, when we started to get to, you know, past that 10 year mark, when we were starting to look for real talent, we had the challenge of and recruited people from other places and brought them into Manitoba, which I found, the only way that really works. And I tell all my portfolio companies, my experience, I got these scars. If you move someone from a different city to a new city, it's like not going to work like 9 times out of 10. But if they're originally from the city and they move away and then they want to move back because of family, which is what I targeted, like people that would move out of Winnipeg, they'd go to Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal and go to school or start their career there. But then they meet someone, they have family, they have a child, and then they want to move back to Winnipeg to get closer to their family. Mm-hmm. Boy, does that work. And so we hired, there's 3 or 4, 5 key people on our marketing team that all were the boomerang. They came back to Winnipeg to work with us. Sure. And then our sales team was basically always remote, you know, so our vice president of sales, number of them were in the US because we were attacking the US market. Our regional sales managers were working out of their home office. And all that worked up until, we got to that $50 million mark. When we got the private equity sponsorship, we actually set up our head office in Minneapolis, and we did that specifically to siphon off the talent of General Mills and the other big food companies that were there. Cause there was just just such a portfolio of great talent in the Twin Cities. So downtown Minneapolis head office, and the business only had that for 4 years ish when it was acquired. Tilray shut that down and moved the head office to New York. But that was our way of I'm getting at the right people.
Makes sense. Yeah. I lived in the Minneapolis area of the Twin Cities. I was the CEO for Mrs. Meyer's Clean Day, the natural soaps, cleaners, detergents right there. So by Target Field, to give you a perspective on location. Part of the reason why I was asking that, because I was almost thinking you might have had more of a hybrid scenario, but it sounds like maybe that wasn't the case, which is fine. Now you're advising and different teams. And so when you think of in-person or fully remote or hybrid, I don't know what your perspective is. In context for that, other than, as we know, the debates going on in business all over the place, constantly on this one, pre-pandemic, the rules were pretty obvious. Most people came in the office all the time, right? For the most part. Then, pandemic, the rules were pretty obvious. Nobody's coming into the office. We're not getting anywhere near each other. Now, the rules are not clear. What's your thoughts? What's advice do you have for your teams today of where to work?
Yeah, it's more about fit, right? So I think about any team member, competency, experience, and fit. Mm-hmm. Your competency and experience, you have to be able to work remotely. But all the rest of it is the same, right? If you're an individual, mm-hmm. some people can and some people can't do that. You know, as an entrepreneur, I've always been on the go, always been traveling to trade shows, to customer visits. So I can pop my laptop open or put my iPhone and my headset in anywhere and I'm working. Yep. But a lot of people can't do that. So even they struggled through the pandemic. But if you have a head of sales or head of marketing or whatever the role is, and they have the competency experience of the role, plus including that they could work remote, it's really about fit. Does the CEO need his or her team in the office? And some founders do. Some founders, I encourage them, say, just wait longer, recruit longer, find that person, because it's going to be really important for you to be able to sit across from this person. And a lot of it because they're still developing as a from founder to CEO. Me personally, if I'm thinking about leadership, I have no issue with where they are, where they're based. If it's remote, I feel like I can lead individuals and teams, and we can be in different cities and use, you know, Zoom or tools like that, and still accomplish what needs to be accomplished.
Here's a would you rather question I just thought of. Would you rather have a team of A+ competent, right? The best leaders coming from the best background. But the team chemistry is like, yeah, the culture is like, eh, but you have really talented people. Like you have, you know, in hockey terms, you've got all Connor McDavid's, I don't know. Or would you rather have B+ talent? So still very talented. I purposely use B+ or A-, however you want to call it. That's the grade. So very talented, but not as talented, but cohesive team chemistry. Where do you go?
Yeah, I think I go with the team chemistry. Like I, when you say A+ or A- or B+, I just want people that have done it before. If you've done it before and you can clearly explain to me what good looks like, what the process looks like, what systems need to be developed, what the scorecard looks like, and you could put that all together because you've done it before, that's mm-hmm. the most important piece for me. And then second most important piece is fit. So when you say you don't have good culture, what that makes me think of is like A+ people that are there and they're really talented and they're thinking about money, but they're not really tied to the core values of the business, you know? And that sounds like a train wreck to me. You know, I want people that are aligned. If we're all about organic and sustainability, I want people that organic and sustainability is important to them. They are going to wear the t-shirt. They're going to tell their friends and family about it. They can't turn it off. They have a hard time turning it off when they're out of the office because they're so excited about the company that they're working at. And if they've done it before, they'll likely be able to do it again. And if they have that fit piece, we're off to the races.
I couldn't agree more. The team is the brand. The brand is the team in a best case scenario. And that seems to be what you guys love and what I love as well.
I'm wearing the uniform today. I haven't worn it in a long time. I needed green today. So
I see it. I was taking it in. We'll have to release this on St. Patrick's Day. Brands and companies do you think are doing that well today when you think of the team is the brand is the team? Who can we look to and say, here, you want a few beacons out there? Here's who you want to look at.
I mean, it comes up often, just because they're putting themselves out there so loudly. But Midday Squares is a great example. You know, like what people see on social media and they share a lot. If you walk into the office, same vibe, same thing. They're a new team member comes in. They're doing a powwow huddle, making a lot of noise, dancing around each other. You know, they're going out and celebrating together. They're going out and at shows, like all being loud and proud. It's the same whether you're in person or your people can sometimes see that and say, oh yeah, that's polished for video. No, it's actually the reason that they're winning is because it's natural and they're just recording it. So that's one that lands pretty true.
Is there a tension point that Midday Squares would have to deal with? Because I get it. I get
some people
that actually comes real. Yeah, to
some
me.
People think they're crazy. You know.
Even internally, it's like, oh my gosh, what am I doing?
Like, yeah, no, like as I've like, so I've, it's been, I've been involved for three, almost 4 years. And then the last like two and a half, as an investor and an advisor, they brought in, they've already gone through and they're really rapidly growing company. Like they're growing 10 times faster than when I grew my business. Cause they've only been in business 5 years and they're, you know, $20 million plus in business. They hired that level of talent at around 10 million of people that have done it before. And some of those people got freaked out because they thought, oh, this is the only way to do it in business because this is the way that I've experienced it and I've done it before. And Midday Square's secret sauce is they're doing it different. You know, they're making a quality product and yeah, they got to be operationally efficient, but they're not scared to put it all out there to the world. Because they're getting more eyeballs on the brand and that just doesn't align with everybody. So yeah, even internally, they had some people that just weren't a fit, but were hired and then found out that they weren't a fit afterwards. And those people thought that they were going to change the culture of MDS, which was not the case. They got, you know, asked to leave the tribe and then now they've re-recruited other talent that is okay, even though they're wild and crazy, understand that that's not going to change. And on their road to $100 million plus or whatever, it's just going to get kind of louder and more of that.
Mike, that's the key though, right? Like this is the message that you're sending out there to everybody. It's going, listen, the team culture is a living ecosystem, right, in every company, and it's unique and different in every company, and it may not be right for you as person A, B, or C out there, and that's okay. This is who we are. This is how we roll. This is the vibe that we have, and we're okay with that. We recognize not everybody's, it's going to fit everybody. And I think it's being comfortable with that.
Yeah, you got to be okay with that. But I think people just don't think of companies like that. They sure think of other things like that in life, like other brands, you know.
Yep.
Oh, I'd never wear a Nike tracksuit out. I always got to be polished up and I'd rather have a Hugo Boss shirt on or something, right? As an example. Yep. Well, then if you went to a company where tracksuits were the culture, you wouldn't be a fit just because of that. That doesn't land up to your values. I don't think a lot of people think like that. I try to coach founders in that fit aspect because it's critically important, especially for longevity. We all know that people can get excited in an interview dance, right? The founder could get excited and met someone that like, oh, this person's done it before. They're an A+ talent and we got to get them on the team. And then the interviewee can be excited because they go, oh, this business is really going somewhere. This could be really, really good and fun and successful for me. And so they both want it to happen, but if the fit's just not there, it won't last for the, you know, 5 years of how long you want this person on the team to make the playoff run, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Another question I have for you, knowing you are so tapped into not just the companies that are operating out there, and thank you for the example of Midday Squares, but also the investment side of things. It's a tough time to raise capital for a lot of these emerging companies in particular, right? What advice do you have for the companies out there that are going, gosh, how do I break through because I'm so cash strapped? I need to bring in some investment. Do you have any advice for the different founders out there?
You know, every situation is different, which makes that a part of the challenge. Worst case scenario is founders that raised at crazy multiples a couple of years ago when that was possible, and they were a small business and they got their cap table offside, they're in a lot of trouble. And those are the companies that you're seeing not be able to access capital or take such a haircut. The only way that they can is to take like a 75% hit to their valuation on their cap table. That's just ugly. So there's that situation going on, and there's probably only one resolve to that is to take that really, really strong down round. But then you have a lot of founders that are in kind of a Me Too space, which is really dangerous nowadays. Like 5 years ago, you could have 10 different versions of cold brew coffee and probably like 7 or 8 of them were getting funded, right? Now it's going back to the times, and I've lived through this, and we started Mentoirs in 1998, then we lived through it in 2008, 2009 financial crisis. Like only the lead horse is going to get financed. Maybe the horse in second is going to get financed. Those two brands. So if you're in a Me Too-ish kind of category and you really don't have strong innovation, that's another reason that you're just not going to get financed. And hopefully you haven't got yourself in a situation where you need financing or you're going to close. And the resolve for you may be to slow things down a little bit so you don't have such a strong use of capital. Because it's truly, you know, as it shifts back to an investor's market from a founder's market, which it was for the last like 3, 4, or 5 years, in an investor's market, only the strong innovation, only the strong founder product market fit, things are going to get well funded, and everybody else is going to suffer, you know. And you know, we saw it. I have the real life example because in 2008, 2009. Is when we took on venture capital. We made that $10 million in revenue. We raised $3 million. All of our competitors couldn't raise money because only the lead horse was getting funded at that time. Mm-hmm. And we outcompeted everybody. In the 2 or 3 years of the financial crisis, we came out the other side and we were a $30 million company, and all of our competitors were just floundering because we accessed the capital. And I think I could see that happening already, because what happens is, you know, when it even gets intensified, right? When those founders don't get funded, their competitors that do, grow 2, 3, 4, 5X, and then, and then it actually gets even worse. So, the fundamentals of, are you creating a truly innovative product that has a moat to it? So you're not a Me Too product. Do you have the proper gross margin, even at a small scale? And can you really control your SG&A spending so you're in control? Even if you're not fully profitable, you're not just bleeding out where someone could say, hey, you only have 3 months of cash left, and that's another reason why, you know, might have challenged funding. That's where companies should put their focus, even if that means like trying to innovate and pivot and create a new product that's outside of their current space.
Mike, how do you lead today without being the person that's now the CEO founder? How do you lead today?
Yeah. By storytelling for the most part. You know, I've went through when we sold Mentable Harvest and I started to become an advisor, a board chairman, a director, even a mentor. I had imposter syndrome of trying to figure out, you know, how do I do this? Like, am I qualified? Yeah, I've done it once in business, but am I qualified? I think I could just do this over and over again in business. But I learned that every entrepreneur's journey is different. My role in it is to say, you're going through XYZ right now. I went through XYZ before. Here's what the story was. Here's what happened to me. Here's what I learned through that. Here's what I would do different if I had the opportunity to do it over again.
Yeah.
And then give that to them. And then the second part is not take it personally, whatever way they go. And obviously it's a little difference. If I'm in a governance role, sometimes there is a thou shall do something, but for the most part, it's here's my experience. Here's the scar I have on my back. Here's what I would do again and different. And then it's the founders, it's the entrepreneur's responsibility to take those insights in and then figure out what that means for their business and then make the decision from there.
That makes total sense. I'm learning from you, by the way, because I've got my own imposter syndrome going on.
Yeah, and then I became a certified board director a couple of years ago now. I went back to school from high school dropout to take in a university course for a year. And the term in in director's education is noses in, fingers out. So we have a role and a responsibility as someone charged with governance to make sure that the train's not going off the tracks, but it's not our role to pull the levers and try to steer that train, right? So noses in, fingers out is a good way to lead from a governance standpoint.
When I think of my, you know, the board members that helped me the most, it was exactly that: noses in, fingers out. Let us do our job. Let us take it from here, if you will.
Yeah. Ask good questions, and the question itself
will guide us.
Well, yeah, guides through the team to do a certain exercise, and that generates a certain outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, I could talk with you all day. I don't want to use any more of your time because I know we're running short here. Is there anything that you feel like you want to mention that we haven't talked about, to the audience, whether it's around culture or leadership?
Yeah, I'm always just want to make sure that people understand the free tools that I have out there. Obviously, I wrote a book, I have a podcast, I have things that people can learn from me from a mentorship standpoint if they choose. But Greg Fleischman, who, you know, introduced us, and Greg and I put together fatafleischman.org, which is a entrepreneur toolbox of all of our forms, tools, and templates that we use to grow our business. It's free. You can go to fatafleischman.org and access some great reading, learning tools, and templates to help grow the business. So I want to make sure that people know about those, because I wish I had them when I was young growing my business.
I love it. Thank you. Where can people find you?
All things Mike Fata at mikefata.ca, mikefata.ca. And then I'm really active on LinkedIn. So if you're hit me up on LinkedIn, tell me you listen to this podcast, and I love connecting with people on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Thank you, Mike, for this dialogue. You really do have a wealth of knowledge through experience, like you said, and sharing that experience. And I think if more of us, including myself for that matter, kind of follow your lead on, you've done it, share it, you can give people a little bit of a shortcut in terms of not going through the same pain that we might have, and also maybe ride the tailwinds of things that we have got if they can recognize them when they see them or when they feel them. So I really, really appreciate that. Thank you. You're a gem.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know what? I'm not a dinosaur, I like to say. I like to stay in the game. You know, I'm learning as much every day of how business is changing, and then can take that experience and now what, you know, because the game constantly changes, and I love playing the game. That's why I'm an entrepreneur. And so thanks again for having me. I love sharing.
Yeah, that's a really good summary too. I feel that both in you and for that matter for myself, I do like being in the game, and I feel like I'm more energized in the last year getting engaged with a lot of different teams and companies that it's almost like I'm getting sharper. I feel like I'm getting sharper again, which is just super fun.
Yeah.
So, well, everyone, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Chief Eternal Optimist podcast. Again, I was here with Mike Fata, and he's a gem. Look him up on LinkedIn. He does have his own podcast as well. And if you are trying to grow your business, this gentleman here has a lot of nuggets and gems that you're going to want to absorb. And quite frankly, just take them and redeploy them. Watch, they'll work better than you think. So thanks for tuning in. We'll see you on the next one, folks.
Okay, team, let's bring it in. Hopefully you take away something today that you're able to reapply to your world. The purpose and intention of this pod is simply to give you the tools to excel both individually and as a team. Let's be crystal clear. Life is a team sport. This applies to the game of life, business, and in sports. I've said this before, there really is an I in team. I was born and raised in Canada, and the French translation for team there is équipe. So yes, literally, there is an I in équipe, and therefore, the meaning of team. It starts with the individual. That's you and me. We flourish with how we manifest our need to be interconnected. All this leading to imagining a future state of the world we want to create. And we will. So that's all for today. Let's go get it.
I would love to hear from each and every one of you, or any one of you. So you can find me at, let me know what you're thinking, on Instagram or Twitter, or known, otherwise known as X today, at the handle clean_lantern. That's clean_lantern. Fire away. And one last request, if I may, and if you feel so compelled, please feel free to leave a review on wherever you listen to your podcasts, and feel free to share as well. Thank you.